Okay, so we are continuing the extended journey through the Bible called that we're calling the whole story. And I need one of these myself. And we have gone through a good portion of the first section of the Bible, and we're into a series of narratives that are very interesting to most people who read them. This is part of the Bible that people like to read because there's a lot of interesting stories. So we're talking about 1 and 2 Samuel, and I've subtitled this sort of the rise of the monarchy. I want to stop for a second before I jump into where we're going today and talk about the timeline and the narrative flow of the Bible. One of the reasons why we're doing this class is because I think it's really important that we all have a sense of like what the basic narrative of the scriptures is. Where does it begin? Where does it end? What happens in the middle? Where is it going? Like, you know, if you're talking about like a movie that you've never seen and someone's talking about that one scene in the movie and you're like, I don't know anything about it because I don't know what happens before or after it. It's the same with the Bible. Like if someone's like, well, here's what I read in Ezra, and you're like, well, I don't know where Ezra fits in the story, then you can easily get lost in that. And so one of the things I want to do is I want to talk about this timeline here. So this one of these sheets here is the front side is like the answer, and the other side is more like a quiz to practice yourself with. And I want to just clarify that the letters have nothing to do, don't match the letters. The letters are different on both sides, so I'll confuse you with that. But I think it'd be really good for you to try to like learn this and practice this, and maybe in a few more weeks I'll come back and I will actually give you this quiz and we'll see how you do on it. But I think it's helpful to figure out where things fall and approximately what date things are happening. Now some of you are not like date people, you're like, I can't remember like when the Constitution was signed and whatever else, it's doesn't matter. But I do think there is something helpful about knowing approximately where you are in the story. Does that make sense? Do you guys think you could do this quiz right now? Anybody think they could actually do it without studying? Just curious. Okay. Peter's like, yeah, kind of. Tom's like, yeah, maybe. Could do it mostly. Hopefully you could get it in the correct order at least, if not get the dates somewhat right on that. So I want to look at the story in seven major acts here. Like if you could think of this as a seven act play, I know there's no such thing, but think of it that way here. So we have creation, we have the fall. This is on your sheet of paper there. We have Abraham, we have Israel, we have Jesus, the church, and then new creation. So at a really big 35,000 foot level, or a broad high view level, these are like what I would think of as the major movements of the story that happened. We've talked about creation. Creation is pretty short. This is really Genesis 1 and 2. Oops, 1 and 2. This here happens in Genesis 3. So there's a lot of action right at the very beginning. And then by Genesis 12, we get Abraham and his family. And then what we're doing is we're building the story towards Israel here. Israel becomes this nation, right? Which is what we've been talking about here. So this is the Exodus and the coming to Sinai and the people of God learning how to be a people together. That's happening there. So this is really like, you can think of this as Exodus through like period of the Judges, is Exodus through all the way through the rest of the Old Testament here. And then you have the New Testament, of course, and then you have our era that we live in. So the New Testament begins the church era, and here's the thing. It doesn't give like the script for like what exactly happens. There's like a break in the story, but we do get the end. So we have the end given to us in Revelation. The very end here, Revelation 21 and 22, gives us a picture of where it's all going. So there's a scholar named N.T. Wright. Are you familiar with that name, anybody? N.T. Wright is a really wonderful, brilliant thinker. And he writes books faster than I can read them. He's so bright. And he has suggested that one way to think of the Bible, and he uses a five-act play instead of a seven-act. I have a little more acts in my play. But he says one way to think of it is to think of this as like a multiple-act play in which you have, in his language, four out of the five
acts, and you had the beginning of the fifth act and the end of the fifth act. And he said, if you were like, you know, in a theater and you didn't have the script, let's say you were trying to do like a Shakespearean play or something like that, then you would have to improv what you think happens between the beginning of the fourth act, the beginning of the fifth act and the end of the fifth act, because there's nothing in there. And he says, that's essentially what we're doing as Christians, is we are improvising the middle of the fifth act. Like, we have all the first four acts, and we have the end and the beginning of the fifth act. We're missing that middle section, and so we're figuring out what does it look like to live in that portion. Does that make sense? I think it's a really helpful illustration for thinking about what we're doing and why the Bible is so important. Because if you were a Shakespearean actor trying to figure out how to play the middle part of the fifth act, you would have to immerse yourself in the first four movements and understand the end in order to figure out what's going on in the fifth, right? You couldn't just get up there and make it up. You'd have to go like, I have to really study this and figure out what's happening. So I'm getting some inquisitive looks. Is that like, does anybody have thoughts about what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Okay, all right. You're a quiet crew this morning here. Where does 1 and 2 Samuel fit in this story? Well, 1 and 2 Samuel is part of this section right here. We're going to spend a lot of time in the next month or two in this part of the story here. So we've set up the whole story to here. Now we have to understand what happens with Israel's story. And 1 and 2 Samuel are part of a larger chunk, one unified narrative with a similar voice. Scholars have noticed that these books all sound like they're using the same narrator, like the voice of the writer is very similar. And so some scholars have thought that these were all compiled perhaps by one editor or one writer who was putting the pieces together. And they call this Deuteronomistic history. Deuteronomistic history, it's kind of a long word there. And it's really Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, and 1 and 2 Kings. Now, 1 and 2 Samuel is interesting because it's actually not two books. It's just one book. But in the olden days, they put all the books on scrolls, and it was too long to fit on one scroll. And so they broke it into two scrolls. So that's why there's 1 and 2 Samuel. But it's one book. It's one unified narrative. And then 1 and 2 Kings are kind of like the corresponding second volume to that. And they fit together as well, too. Now, what's a little bit confusing is when you read through the Old Testament, the books of the Old Testament are not actually in chronological order. They're roughly in chronological order. In some parts, and then other parts they're not at all. So that's a little confusing, right? Like if you have a book and you're like trying to read through it, any other book you think of usually goes in like chronological order, or you recognize there is no chronology to the book, it's just a series of essays or poems or something like that. But to have a book that's intended to be a story but then doesn't fall in chronological order is like a recipe for confusing people. Have you found that confusing? Anybody found that confusing before? Okay, yeah, I got some vigorous nods over here. Have you seen a list of how the books go in order? Anybody seen that? Maybe I should bring one of those in. That might be helpful to like outline where they fit. Because what you have is you have these narratives, and then you have all these prophetic books, the prophets, which correspond to different parts of Israel's history. And yeah, so that's a little confusing. And then to make things even more confusing, you have overlap. So in 1 and 2, let's see, just to say the books of Samuel and Kings overlap with, or they overlap with Chronicles. So if you read these two books side by side, you'd see that they're telling the same stories essentially. But here's what's even more confusing about it, is that Chronicles doesn't tell some of the stories that Samuel King tells, because in this part of Israel's story, there is a moment where, on your map, on your narrative timeline here, look at your narrative timeline. There's a section there, a letter E, on the full description of it here, letter E, is where the kingdom of Israel divides. So up until the year 922, you have a unified kingdom. So you really have from about the year, you could say about the year 9-something, this is when David reigns, it's about the year 1000. But from here until Solomon's sons, then you have the kingdom divides into two kingdoms. You have the northern kingdom, which is called confusingly Israel, but is not the whole people, right? It's Israel, the northern kingdom. And then this southern kingdom is called Judah, which is also confusing because it includes more than just Judah. It's Judah and half the tribe of Levi. So, half the tribe of Benjamin, I'm sorry. So, am I completely confusing everybody right now? Are you with me? Just give me a nod. Okay. So what I'm trying to say here is that Samuel and Kings tells... this is a separate thing here. Samuel and Kings tells both of these stories here. Chronicles, however, does not tell the northern story. And here's why. Because the northern kingdom, the 10 northern tribes here, these are the 10 northern tribes, actually... their story ends in the year 722. So in the year 722, the Assyrians come in, they destroy the northern capital of Samaria, they disperse the peoples, they put new peoples in there, they mix together, and so that they dilute out the identity of the people of God. So there isn't actually a clear sense of who is actually Israel anymore. And so that story ends in the year 722. However, when Chronicles is being written, it's being written after quite a ways after here, somewhere in this around the 6th century here. So that story continues on, and the story of the people of that are, we call the Jews are the people that are traced through this story here. But that's confusing to us because when we go back to the Old Testament and we read back here in the story of Abraham and his sons, there's the 12 tribes, and the 12 tribes are really an important number, right? So when Jesus comes along, he picks 12 men to build a new Israel, in a sense. And then there's all this confusion about what happened to the northern 10 tribes. Now, this is like a side note that's just random, but if you know anything about Mormonism has claimed that the 10 tribes immigrated to North America and that those are the Native Americans. Unfortunately, that true has not been proved true because they do genetic testing on them. And there's not really any links back to the Middle East with these folks. But so there's a lot of random like stuff that happens around that. But the point for us is that the Northern Kingdom ends in the year 722 with the Assyrian demolition of it. The Southern Kingdom goes through something else called the exile later on of their own. They have an exile where the Babylonians come in and destroy them. However, they return to the land, and that story continues on. Okay, are you picking up what I'm laying down here? All right, welcome out there in the hinterlands. So glad you're here with us here. Okay, why was I talking about all this? I'm trying to remember now why I was talking about it. Oh yeah, because I was trying to tell you about Samuel, 1 and 2 Samuel and where it fits. So 1 and 2 Samuel is part of the earlier story that tells both the northern and the southern kingdom's story, okay? It's a little more robust, has a little more detail. When we come to Chronicles, which I don't know if we're going to spend a lot of time on Chronicles, but Chronicles is interesting also because it focuses only on the southern kingdom, but it gives a positive spin to all things David. So in the Chronicles stories, David is not seen to be the massive like goof up and failure that he is repeatedly in 1 and 2 Samuel and Kings. Like he is given he looks like the golden boy. Like he's like the standard. And that is interesting because, it's just it's a way of going back and saying, this guy was the best of a lot of bad kings. It's one way to look at it there. So okay. So moving along to the next section here, I want to talk about the books of Samuel and how they can be broken up into 5 narrative sections here. And then we want to look at the rise of the kingship together. So there are 5 major sections here. There's the story of Samuel, who is called. And last week, John Trammell did a great job. I listened to the recording. He did a great job of introducing us to Judges and then the book of Ruth. And he talked about how the judges were a pretty rough period of time for the people of God. Samuel comes at the end of that time period. Eli is like a leader of the people. He's a prophet. Eli is kind of corrupt. He's lost his connection to the Lord in a sense. Samuel grows up and he becomes this massively important figure in the story here. He is a priest. He is a prophet. He is a warrior. He's a judge. He does all those things. He's like kind of a Renaissance man before the Renaissance there. And then the next section there is the rise of the monarchy. Saul is chosen as the first king. He gains credibility with the people. At first, they don't know what to do with the king because they've never had a king. They're like, what do we do with the king? They wanted a king. But then he loses credibility, and then he forfeits the divine authority. And then there's the story of David's rise to power. And David is this complex character. He has a complex story because he is anointed as king, which I'll actually preach about today. That's part of the lectionary. He is anointed as king, but Saul is still living. The first king is still living, so there's this really like weird tension between like Saul and David, and there's all these stories of like Their like families are interrelated. Like David marries Saul's daughter. He's like a war hero for Saul. But then Saul's really threatened by him, so he's trying to kill him. And then David spares his life multiple times. And all that stuff happens over a long period of time until finally Saul dies. And then David is anointed and he takes over, which is the next part there. And then the final part is kind of like the tragic end of David's story, which David's family is a mess. His sons, some of them kill each other. One of his sons tries to take over the kingdom. Absalom, you've heard of Absalom before? The guy who has like flowing hair, great hair, like Yanni before. Anyone know Yanni? All right, sorry, that's a really bad reference. He has this flowing hair. He's this really good-looking guy. He's charismatic, and he tries to pull a coup on his father. He like tries to take over the kingdom from his dad, and his dad lets him do it. And so David goes into exile for a short period of time, and then he has to come back. And it's just really sad to see what happens. So David's kind of a weird character. Okay, so that's the broad overview. How many of you know the stories of David? Do you guys know this section of the Bible very well? How many people feel like they don't really know this section? Just out of curiosity here. Okay, so some people are like just learning the story. The best way to learn it is to just read it. Really, I'm not just being like weird about that. Like, just go to the Bible and read it. Sit down and read Samuel and Kings. And they're really interesting reading. Honestly, there's a lot of stories and battles and interesting stuff happening. And then I'm not going to show it today, but you know those videos we've been showing from the Bible Project? They're really, really helpful as an overview of like what is going on in the story. So I would strongly recommend that. Okay. So what I want to do is I want to look at the passages here about the rise of the monarchy, because this is a really important part of that story. So if you have your Bible, you want to open with me to 1 Samuel 8. If you do not have your Bible, I have conveniently printed it out on this sheet of paper for you. So I would love to get some people to help read this. Can we do this? Can we just start reading paragraphs and go down here? And we'll finish that first section where the dotted line is, end there, okay? So it'll be about 4 or 5.
When Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn son was Joel, and the name of his second, Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. Yet his sons did not follow in his ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice.
So all the elders of Israel gathered together and approached Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, "Look, you are old and your sons don't follow your ways. So now appoint us a king to lead us, just as all the other nations have."
But the thing that displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to govern us," Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, "Listen to the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them, just as they have done to me for the day I brought them up out of Egypt to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods. So also they are doing to you. Now then, listen to their voice. Only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them."
So Samuel reported all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. He said, "These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to his horsemen, and to be his horsemen, and to run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his implements of war and the equipment of his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his courtiers. He will take 1/10 of your grain and of your vineyards and give it to his officers and his courtiers. He will take your male and female slaves and the best of your cattle and donkeys and put them to his work. He will take 1/10 of your flocks, and you shall be his slaves. And in that day, you will cry out because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves. But the Lord will not answer you in that day."
But the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel. They said, "No, but we are determined to have a king over us so that we also may be like other nations, and that our king may govern us and go out before us and fight our battles." When Samuel heard all the words of the people, he repeated them in the ears of the Lord. The Lord said to Samuel, "Listen to their voice and set a king over them." Samuel then said to the people of Israel, each of you return home.
Okay, pause. So that was a large section there, but let's review what happened here. So the first thing is that Samuel is getting old. And he has sons who are supposed to follow him and like continue to teach the people the way of the Lord, but his sons are corrupt. They're not good fellows. So the people are like, we don't want your sons. We want a king. And do you notice the reason why? What is the reason why they want a king? It's repeated several times. To be like the other nations, right? So they're like looking around. They're like, we want to be like everyone else. It reminds me of when I was a kid and like our neighbors had video game consoles and we did not have them at our home. And we were like, Mom and Dad, why can't we have video games? Everyone else has them. Look at all the neighbors. They have them. And they're like, we're not like the neighbors. That was their answer. So, but this is what's going on here. So they want to be like their neighbors. Why is that a problem? Can someone help me understand? Yeah, Diane.
Because God set Israel apart from his people.
Yes, the whole point of the story has been to set a people apart, to not be like their neighbors, right? And how are they not supposed to be like their neighbors? What are the key pieces of that there?
They're who worship the Lord their God.
Okay.
The love their heart, the love their soul, the love their mind, and they should love their neighbors as themselves.
That's a great summary known as the Shema that you are giving us here. So they're supposed to be monotheistic, right? They're to serve one God. They're not to have any idols. And what are they saying here? They want to be like the other nations around them that have all these other gods and have kings and all these things like that. So this is a key piece here. And then notice what Samuel does here. So he like hears this from them. He goes to the Lord. He complains to the Lord. He's like, you know, they want a king. And the Lord is like, listen to them, right? And then he tells them to warn the people. And what does he warn them with? What is his basic warning? Can you surmise what he's trying to say there? Or summarize it?
In fact, your king will oppress you.
Yes! Your king is not going to help you. He's going to take your children and make them his servants. He's going to take your land. He's going to ask for taxes. He's going to do all the things that like kings do. Do you really want this? Do you really want a king? Right? And he gives them the full warning about how it's going to go. And they're like, we want a king. And so he's like, so God tells Samuel, all right, give him a king. And so he sends them on home. And let's look at the next section here. So 1 Samuel 12. Can we continue reading around there? Can you start, Martine, there, that little section there? And then, actually, I'll do the first part here because it's confusing. 1 Samuel 12, 1 and 2. Samuel said to all Israel, I have listened to you in all that you have said to me and have set a king over you. See, it is the king who leads you now. I am old and gray. Now, what happens between these three or four chapters here is that the story of Saul happens. Saul is chosen to be the king. Samuel then goes on in this chapter to defend his reputation. He retells the story of God's redemption of Israel from Egypt, the rescue cycle of the judges that we've talked about. And then starting in verse 11, can you do that part there? Start there. Okay, pause for a second. Who are those guys? Judges. The last part, the last book that we just talked about last week, they're the characters in that book. And they're not great characters, but they were used by God to rescue people. Keep going. That's great.
And you lived in safety. But when you saw that King Nahash of the Ammonites came against you, you said to me, no, but a king shall reign over us, though the Lord your God was your king. See, here is the king whom you have chosen, for whom you have asked. See, the Lord has set a king over you. If you will fear the Lord and serve him and heed his voice and not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, and if both you and the king who reigns over you, will follow the Lord your God, it will be well. But if you will not heed the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you and your king. Now therefore, take your stand and see this great thing that the Lord will do before your eyes.
Let's go back to the back. Nicholas, can you read for us?
Is it not the wheat harvest today? I will call upon the Lord, that he may send thunder and rain. You shall know and see that the wickedness that you shall have done in sight of the Lord is great in a demanding king for yourselves. So Samuel called upon the Lord, and the Lord sent thunder and rain that day. And all the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. All the people said to Samuel, pray to the Lord your God for your servants, so that we may not die, for we have added to all of our sins the evil of a demanding of a king for ourselves.
And Samuel said to the people, "Do not be afraid, for you have done all this evil, yet do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart, and do not turn aside after useless things that cannot profit or save, for they are useless. For the Lord will not cast away his people for his great name's sake, because it has pleased the Lord to make you a people for himself. Moreover, as for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by ceasing to pray for you. I will instruct you in the good and the right way. Only fear the Lord and serve him faithfully with all your heart, for consider what great things he has done for you. But if you still do wickedly, you shall be swept away, both you and your king."
Okay, the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Okay, so what happens here? This is like the rest of the story here. They want a king, in particular, now that we know, because this other king of the Ammonites, Nahash, came against them, and they were afraid. They wanted a king. So now they have a king. And notice that the sense here that they are rejecting the Lord as king. Did you catch that? That's partly what's going on here. There's a sense of distrust here, right? Now, I don't know exactly what God had in mind, but it seems like up until this point, he has ruled them as their king, and they're kind of a loose federation of like tribal peoples who all recognize him. But there isn't like a centrally located power structure. There's just like a charismatic leader that comes up from time to time. So then Samuel has this moment here where he's trying to like... give them a sense of like the power. I think it's a kind of a fascinating piece here. So he's like, "I'm going to pray that God will bring thunder and rain." And like he prays and God brings like thunder and rain. And the people are like, "Oh, wow, there's like real power here, you know." And so then they're like, "We think we may have done wrong because you told us not to do this king thing." But Samuel's like, "It's too late. You're doing this king thing. Now just do it faithfully, right?" So that's the way the whole king thing gets set up. Have you read this or thought about this stuff before, about the rise of the kingship? I don't know if this is news to some of you. Some of you have it. Mark.
So how does a king differ from a judge?
That's a great question. So a king is like a judge in that he is considered to be a military leader, but also the king has a household that is expected that the children following him will all be part of the royal family, whereas a judge is just a one-off thing. There's not an expectation as to the next generation of the judge's family will continue to be the judge. So that's one of the distinctions there. Yeah. What other questions or thoughts come forward for you guys about this?
One thing that has always confused me about this is that, like, it seems like this is pretty different than God's original plan, maybe, for Israel. But then they just, like, ask for a king, and he's like, "Okay, you know, not really my plan, but, you know, sure, we'll change the whole kind of story, maybe, like, because you asked for it." Which I don't think is really the case, but it's like there's something interesting going on there.
Like you're thinking God might be a little too flexible with his plan here. Yeah. How does this play into like where the story goes? Like if we go back to the movements of the story, can you see how a king, like where the king plays in here?
Well, so that's actually another part that confuses me. Because like later on, you know, if you go to the New Testament, it's like Jesus is always referencing David, and like I'm from like the lineage of David, and like I'm gonna be your king, and it's like there's a lot of symbolism there. But then like it like so ultimately it's like if you look at God's view of like, you know, the whole plan, it's like, okay, it looks like he had this plan for like a king, who he is the lineage of, but then it's like kinda in this like trajectory where it kind of is made to seem like the whole king thing is like not part of the plan, it's kinda like.
Yeah, it looks like that, right?
Yeah.
So this is kind of how the story goes. It starts out with God as king, then it goes to a human king, and then where does it go?
God is king.
A human God is king. Like, God and human, like there's like this Jesus is humanity, and like he is God in human flesh, right? And so it wraps these two together in a sense. Which is an interesting way that the story resolves, right? Like, it's almost like God weaves this into his plan. Maybe, I mean, this is like the messianic hope is that we'll have this really good king. But they've never really had that great of a king, actually, to be honest truth. And so when Jesus comes along and he is crucified. This is the confusing part, right? Then Jesus is, when he's recognized as king, he's being crucified. You're like, here's your king. That's what Rome says. Here's your king, king of the Jews. By the way, we're killing him right now. You see why that was like a crazy twist in the story. It's like, finally our king has arrived. Oh, he's being killed. That's a problem, right? So, yeah. Was there someone else saying something? I didn't know if there was another thought or question in the room.
I mean, it seems, in some respect, it's consistent with the pattern of just man. Every time man takes his eyes off God, things fall apart.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you start back with the garden, when there was perfection, I mean, man communed with God. It all worked. There was then the fall and sin, and when that got broken,
yeah,
mankind went, it was again into your chaos.
Yeah.
And so then, so God's plan back from the garden was always, he was directly our king, we had a direct relationship with him.
Yeah.
It was messed up, and as you said, it was ultimately reconciled with Christ. He kind of brought the sinful world,
yeah,
the fallen world, and his plan back together again.
Yeah. I love that you're bringing in the garden, because I think the garden is key to this story too. So God is the creator of over the creation, right? But then he establishes a kind of kingly sense of like Adam and Eve, right? They're to have dominion. Well, who has dominion? Kings have dominion, right? Kings and queens, they have dominion over the earth. So in a sense, where Adam went wrong, God took the reins back himself, right? And then the people asked for a king, but it wasn't in the way that God was meaning to do it necessarily. And then later on, Jesus as the king is the new Adam. That's one of the ways that Paul talks about him, is the new Adam, right? And then in him, this is crazy. So in the New Testament, we know that in Christ, it says that we are to judge angels. Have you heard that in the New Testament? It's a very strange passage. Paul's like, don't you know that we're to judge angels? And we're like, no, I didn't know that actually. And this is why, because we are bound up into Jesus' identity as in his authority, and we have authority actually over these powerful angelic beings only in and through Christ. So that the authority structure that we get pulled into being co-regents, co-reigning with Christ for all eternity. That's the language of the New Testament. So the whole idea of the king plays lots of different pieces in the story, which is very interesting. Does that make sense, what I'm saying? Are you following me? Okay. I want to talk for a few minutes about David, because we're not going to go into all the details of the stories about David's life and all that. When you think of David, what story or stories most define David for you? Anybody have thoughts? There's not a right answer on this. I'm just curious what
David
you think.
And Goliath.
David and Goliath. Okay. And what about that story is striking to you, or what defines David around that? Like, what stands out to you about that story?
Took down the baby.
Okay, so here's like a little boy, young man,
yeah,
who without real weapons, just a slingshot, right, takes down the giant who has the armor and the swords and the spear and all that stuff like that, right? So in this story, what is David known for?
Bravery.
Like, okay, yeah, bravery. And
faith,
right? There's a real sense that he is like trusting God to do what God's going to do. Did you say something, Jeff?
Faith.
Okay, echoing. We have a choir saying faith in here. Okay, what else? What other stories define David for you?
We'll just go the opposite direction, Bathsheba.
Yes, these are kind of the two poles of David's life here, right? So you have David, David and Bathsheba. What's the story of Bathsheba? For those of us who don't remember the story.
Use of power, adultery, murder.
Like, it's pretty bad, right? So David's the king. He's out on his porch one day looking down over the rest of his subjects, and he sees a beautiful woman bathing on the porch. What is not clear in the text immediately to us, but we know from reading around the text, is that this woman is probably not unknown to David. She's the wife of one of his best friends. Uriah the Hittite is not some random dude. Uriah is one of David's closest like army commanders. He's like a brother in battle with David. So David is like, who's that beautiful woman? Bring her up. And then he has this affair with her. She gets pregnant. He tries to cover it up by bringing back Uriah from the battlefield to like try to pretend like they slept together and made this child. But Uriah is too noble and honorable. He won't go sleep with his wife because all of his fellow companions and brothers are not with their wives. So he's like sleeping on his front porch instead of in the bedroom. So none of this is working. So he can't cover it up. So finally David's like, the cover-up's not working. What are we going to do? And so he sends Uriah out with a message in his own hand given to the commander to say, put me on the front. He doesn't know it, but it says, put me on the front lines and then draw back so that they kill me, essentially. So that's what happens. Uriah is out on the front lines. The whole rest of the army pulls back, leaves this guy all by himself. He's brutally murdered on the front lines. And this is supposed to be the cover-up. And David appears to be getting away with it, right? And then the child is born, and the child... Okay, so before that, though, it looks like he's getting away with it, and then this guy comes and he confronts David. Does anybody know his name?
Nathan.
Nathan, my son! That's why I named my son Nathan. Yes, so Nathan is a prophet, and he comes into David, and he like tells him the story, or the sad story about this guy who only has like one precious little sheep that's his own, and then that he goes to visit the king or whatever. The king has like hundreds of sheep, and the king asks him to like sacrifice his only one lamb. And he's like, and David's like, who is this man? He's an evil person. And Nathan puts his finger in his chest and he goes, you are the man. You are that man. And then he goes, you're the one who did this. And he confronts him about Bathsheba and Uriah. And David, to his credit, repents actually about the whole thing. But you see in this a very dark side of David. Like very, very dark. So here's the question I was thinking about this week. If you met David, would you want to be his friend? What's your thought on that?
You don't want to be his enemy.
That is true, actually. That's a great answer, yeah. Want to be a friend of me? Yeah.
It's kind of which David are you going to meet?
Yeah, right? Because there's also all these stories about David, too, being so honorable that he has the chance to kill Saul earlier on, like multiple chances. He doesn't do it. He's like, Saul's his mortal enemy, not because he wants him to be, because Saul hates him and is threatened by him, but David won't kill him. There's a story about David inspiring huge amounts of loyalty with his own subjects, with his own people, when he's kind of like a roving bandit. He has a group of people that come with him. And at one point, he's like, man, I just really want the water from this one spring. And his men are like, but it's like behind enemy lines. And his men are like, we're going to get you that water. They don't tell him, though. And so they break through the enemy lines. They go and get him the water from this particular spring. And they bring it back to him. And he's like, what did you guys do? Why would you do that? Like, why would you like risk your lives to bring me water? And he's like, I can't drink this. And so he pours it out on the ground because he's like too noble to like drink this water that could have cost them their life. So he's got this noble streak in him as well, too. He's like fiercely loyal to this guy, Jonathan, right? There's all those stories about him and Jonathan. So what do you say? Would you want to be David's friend or not? I'm curious what you'd say. You said better than being his enemy. Yeah, Nathan.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, he seems to come around after you tell him off.
So right.
Maybe he's willing to repent and learn.
So there's some humility in him there. Yeah. Yeah.
Comment on it. I find it an odd question, do you want to be a friend? Because to me, this whole story and this series of stories strikes me as categorizing the people as this monolithic group who all say, give us a king.
Yeah.
He ignores completely the personal level where there's probably debate and there's differing opinions.
Mm-hmm.
And then you say, well, on a personal level, would you like to be his king? Of course not. It seems like the message is humans are flawed and they're easily corrupted by power.
Mm.
And the only person you can trust, or not person, the only being you can trust or force you can trust is God. Mm. So
you're saying maybe it's not even a good question. I think it's a fair critique of the question, actually. I thought about this, and I answered it, yes, I would want to be his friend. Because I think he would be a remarkable person to be around. I would keep my wife away from him. I would not let him know who my wife was, because I would not trust him around her, for sure. Here's the thing, though. Would I let David be a leader in the church? Definitely not. I'd be like, no way, buddy. Which is a funny thing because, like, David's one of the great heroes of the faith, but he wouldn't be an elder in our, he wouldn't be a leader in our church. He wouldn't qualify, honestly. So, Diane.
This is sort of a rabbit trail, but not too much. It says that after everything David did, David was still a man after God's own heart. And but there's consequences. And we saw a lot of consequences to all his actions. I mean, he was a terrible father.
Mm-hmm.
But the family. I mean, this is the stuff we know.
Yeah.
We don't know what else is going on. But this was really a dysfunctional family, and with all he did with his leadership. But because he always sought repentance and he always sought the face of God, he was a man after God's own heart. There was consequences, and the biggest consequence he had, what was the one thing he really wanted to do? He wanted to rebuild the temple. Mm-hmm. And God said, no, you don't get to do that. That's a consequence of all this other stuff.
Yeah.
But his son was given that honor.
Yeah. That's a great word. And do you remember why God says you can't build the temple? Because you have too much bloodshed on your hands. Your hands have been like involved in too much bloodshed. And so he gives it the opportunity to David's son to build the temple, which is a great honor, right? So there's this one wonderful passage where God comes to David, or David comes to God and he says, I want to build you a house. And God's like, that's great. Actually, I'm going to build your house. And by that, he means like the house of David's like royal family, that he's going to build him a lineage there. So there's something that is beautiful and like humble about David, and there's a lot that's like really despicable about David. But we have to remember that we're like really early in the story. Like there aren't that many great characters in the Bible so far. Like we stand on the shoulders of all these people because, and it's easy for us to look back and go, yeah, well, like we wouldn't have done that. But actually they lived in very different times and in very different contexts. And so I think it's wise to be gracious towards the biblical characters, even if we evaluate them in ways that would leave them less than noble in our minds. Yeah, Mark?
Isn't it impressive that the Bible is so frank about the flaws of their heroes?
Yeah.
They don't try to hide it at all.
Right. Abraham, the great hero of faith, is like, you know, foisting his wife off as his sister, right, and like doing weird things. David's a murderer, an adulterer, like all sorts of stuff is in the story here. And I like what you're saying, Jeff. I think ultimately it is pointing us towards saying that humanity is failing and flawed in many ways. And God is the one we can trust in the end of the story there. So, yeah, I find that encouraging. This was like a fairly like kind of pathetic attempt to try to get into 1 and 2 Samuel. There's a lot there. And one of the things I really hope is that you guys will actually read the Bible and feel like you know enough of what's going on around it to have it make sense to you. So again, I want to keep drawing our attention back to the bigger picture story as to where we are. So take that little like practice timeline home and maybe do a little bit of like thinking about that and practice on that. And then we'll do a little quiz one of these days about the actual big picture story. Okay, I think we're out of time, so let's go ahead and stand up together and say a prayer.